From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Since the 1980s, the State Department has sent more than 7,000 refugees to New Hampshire for resettlement, along with many thousands more across the U.S. Unlike most immigrants, refugees didn't choose to leave home. They had to for their safety due to war, ethnic violence, or political persecution. And over the years, they've come from countries like Vietnam, Bosnia, Sudan, Bhutan, Iraq, and now Syria. But the newest arrivals come at a difficult time. Some Americans are afraid that refugees present a terrorism risk, and those fears were heightened this week after ISIS claimed responsibility for a deadly attack in Berlin, Germany. Today in The Exchange, U.S. refugee policy and its impact here. Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have four guests with me in studio. Is Mukhtar Idao. He's executive director of ORIS. That's an organization for refugee and immigrant success, which provides training and services to promote self-sufficiency for refugees. Mukhtar himself arrived as a refugee from Somalia in 2004. Mukhtar, it's nice to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Also with us, Jeffrey Thielman. He's president and chief executive officer for the International Institute of New England, which provides humanitarian relief and helps refugees and immigrants resettle. And Jeffrey, welcome back. Good to see you, too.
Thank you. Good to see you.
And also with us, Abdul Wakil. He's a new Syrian refugee and electrical engineer who arrived in Manchester just this fall with his wife, three children, and parents. And Abdul Wakil, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for your time.
Nice to meet you. Thank you.
And joining us in a few minutes will be Ted Gatzis, mayor of Manchester and a former Republican state senator. Again, the number for you to join us with your questions and comments is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And Mukhtar, I want to start with you. Where are the refugees that you're working with in Manchester coming from these days? And just how has the whole picture in Manchester changed since you yourself arrived 12 years ago?
So we don't do resettlement in ORIS. We only have two resettlement agencies in New Hampshire. ORIS is an ethnic community-based organization, basically founded to provide services to refugees after the initial resettlement period. That people still need services. Our goal is to get people off public services to a self-sufficiency, where we provide employment services, training, and youth services, all programs that are essential to refugee life. 2012, my experience is from 2012, because that's when I came here. Around that time, there was a large number of Somali Bantus coming into the country. There was 15,000 Somali Bantus that were given resettlement out of the northeastern province of Kenya. I was a part of that group. We came to New Hampshire. I have to say I've been amazed to see how I was welcomed in New Hampshire. I lived in a refugee camp, so I've experienced both how life is in the refugee camp and living in a civil war in where Somalia in 1991 when the civil war broke out. So coming here was a life-changing for me in 2004. I was fortunate enough to have gone to school in Kenya, worked with non-profits there, worked with our communities in the camp in Kenya. So I had a feeling of what the community needs were even before coming to the U.S. So coming here, I initiated the idea of forming ethnic community-based organization to culturally appropriate respond to the needs of the people who are coming. At that time, was Somali Bantu. So ORIS basically was Somali Bantu Community Association of New Hampshire. We were primarily targeting that particular group at that moment. I was amazed on New Hampshire, how New Hampshire was responding to the refugees. We had a lot of amazing social workers, caseworkers. We worked with the resettlement agencies both in Manchester and Concord on how better serve refugees. ORIS has played a major role in making sure that people do not depend on public services. We worked with businesses and employers. And since then, the number of refugees that have been coming in have been changing because the world is changing every day. Then we had the Bhutanese after the Somali Bantu communities that
yes,
have been coming in the last few years. And then we had Congolese after the Bhutanese slowed down. And now we have Syrians. I'm not sure what the number is in Syria, Syrians refugees in New Hampshire, but I'm very aware of a large number of refugees from Congo, Bhutan, and Somalia have been resettled in New Hampshire because those were the ones that we've been working with.
Well, and we'll hear Abdul Wakil's story in just a moment. But just remind us, Mukhtar, what it was like for you to arrive from Somalia, again, more than a decade ago, here in New Hampshire. I mean, culture shock, weather shock, geography shock.
I think
please don't tell me you arrived from Africa in the winter, because that's
the
harsh.
The winter was shocking, but it was not comparable to the life I have gone through in my own country under the refugee camp. So if I had to compare, I would rather have the winter and live in a better life in the U.S. So really, it was cold. It wasn't the temperature we were used to living in. But that was nothing compared to the suffering we have gone through in Somalia when the civil war broke out, refugee camp where you have no rights to move around off the camp. You've been supported by a gift from UNHCR, food.
The United Nations.
No rights as a refugee in the camp in Kenya, even if you've been here for 20 years. I lived in Kenya for 20 years as a refugee. And
20 years 20 in a refugee camp?
And I had no rights. So coming here was a life-changing. After 5 years, I became U.S. citizen. I got all those kind of rights, the right to vote, the right to work for U.S. government if I want to. So there's a lot of change in my life, I have to say. So winter is nothing compared to what I've gone through.
to 20 years in a refugee camp.
20 years
You'll
in
take
refugee
it.
Camp.
You'll put your boots and coat on and
yeah,
not
and I
complain.
Show I've been doing my best. I myself have created small businesses in New Hampshire, and in addition to being involved in non-profits. So those are some of the successes that refugees come into.
Well, and Jeff, I explained a little bit at the top, but do you think most people understand the difference between an immigrant and a refugee and the big role that the State Department plays in all this?
I don't know if most people understand, but I can try to explain it.
Sure.
Refugees are people who cross an international border. They leave Syria or the Democratic Republic of Congo or Iraq or Afghanistan. They cross an international border. They're in another country. And they go to the UN High Commissioner for Refugees office and they apply for refugee status. They say they have a well-founded fear of persecution. They cannot go home to their country. And then they apply for a visa to come to the United States or another country as a refugee. So that process involves – it's a two-year process minimum to go through the U.S. process of being resettled into this country as a refugee. You have to demonstrate a well-founded fear of persecution because of your religious beliefs, because of your political situation, because you were in a war zone that you can't go back to. Right now, the United Nations estimates there's about 21.3 million people who are refugees around the world of the 65 or so million that have been displaced by war and conflict worldwide. The United States State Department runs a program, a very tight, well-run, well-oiled machine in which refugees go through lots of vetting, about 9 different security screens before they come to the country. They're interviewed throughout the process of applying to the U.S. They come to the United States as refugees. They have legal status and they have the right to all benefits that all of us have the right to. We resettle refugees like the people here at the table. We help them. We find a home for them when they come to the United States. We help them enroll in public schools. We help them get all the public benefits to which they're entitled. And then we help them get jobs as quickly as they possibly can. And within a year of being in the United States, they can get a green card. Within 5 years, they can become a citizen of the country.
Well, a couple more questions for you, Jeff, and then I do want to hear from you, Abdul Wakil. And it's amazing that you're sitting in front of a radio microphone after you've only been in this country for, you know, a month or two. But, Jeff, what's the difference between what in Europe they call an asylum seeker and a refugee here in this country? Because some of the problems we've heard about happening in Europe are, you know, they're often tied to what are called asylum seekers. Is there a difference?
Yeah, there's a big difference. Refugees go through a screening process overseas before they get to the United States. So they're screened by U.S. State Department, Homeland Security, and other officials for a period of about 2 years. They go through a cultural orientation program. They get prepared to come to the United States. They have the screening, and then they're accepted into the United States. There's a biometric exam. There's interviews of people before they come here. So it's a very tightly run process. There are 21.3 million refugees in the world. The United States accepts about 110,000 this year. That's our goal as a country. So we don't accept a lot of refugees in this country. The process is very controlled, tightly managed by the State Department, the Department of Homeland Security, the United States Immigration Service, our Citizen Immigration Service, and all of our security forces are involved in checking refugees before they get here.
Well, and one last question for you, Jeff, please. Mukhtar told us that he was in a refugee camp in Kenya, fleeing the war in Somalia for 20 years, right, Mukhtar? That's what you said, 20
yes.
years. That just seems crazy to sit in a refugee camp for 20 years. Why does it take so long?
Well, the average time a refugee stays in a camp is about 17 years. It takes a long time because there's no other place to go. I mean, there's no places for refugees to go. They're not, you know, they're not, there's just not a lot of countries that want to accept refugees. And so they're trying to get out. They're trying to survive. They're trying to find a new place to live. And there's really no place to go.
All right. Well, and Mayor Ted Gatsis, mayor of Manchester, is with us, former Republican state senator. Mayor Gatsis, welcome. Thank you. Good morning. How are you? Really appreciate it. And I do want to hear your story, Abdul Wakil. There's been a lot of coverage just this week about how terrible it is in Aleppo, people trying to get out, afraid they're going to be killed on the way. How did you and your family make it out? And where did you go?
Yes. The revolution started in Syria very safe, no violent, but the regime chose to face these people by weapons, to face these people by live bullets. So we were in Syria, wake up many times during the night to the sound of missiles come pass over us.
Wow.
Yes, and we thought that the next missile will fall over us, will fall upon us directly.
This is when the protests and revolution first started, right, about
five years ago. And when we wake up next day, we find some bullets inside the house. We find some deaths in the street. Before we sleep, we try to gather our children in the middle of the house, to not shout it for them directly. So it was very terrible situation. Then we flee from homes to Damascus, from Damascus to Egypt. We stay in Egypt for about 4 years.
In a refugee camp, right?
Yes.
In Egypt.
And we register in International Institute in Egypt, waiting for resettle in another safe place. And International Institute chose our family to resettle in America here, in the United States. And there is before we came to here, there was a lot of vids. There was a lot of investigation about us to know everything about us. So we feel safeness because of this, a lot of investigation. So there is no bad people will coming to here.
The background check took a long time.
Yes. They want to know everything about us, everything about family that came to here. But it's very difficult story for us. It's very difficult to see that all people killed only to say we want to freedom, only to say for justice. A lot of people died in the sea while fleeing from this crazy war because they are seeking about another safe place for them, for their children, for their families. So we hope this international war now, we hope it will finish soonly.
Well, and I have a lot more questions that I will ask you about your family, your kids, how they're doing, because it's definitely a traumatic experience fleeing from that war and having to resettle. But I want to bring Mayor Gatsis in, too, and welcome Mr. Mayor. And you've been talking about refugee resettlement for a long time in Manchester. Mukhtar gave us a sense of just how it's changed over the years. What has refugee resettlement meant for your city, Mayor Gatsas?
Well, there's no question that Manchester is a great melting pot, and it always has been, whether it's with refugees or immigrants. It certainly has. I'm a second-generation immigrant. My grandparents came from Greece and Lebanon, so I understood exactly what it was about and how close the community was to helping them. Some of the things that I've talked about is certainly I've talked to the president and also to the education secretary about having students that come to this country that haven't had a day of education in their own language, let alone English, that we waive the testing for them for a four-year period. If they've had education in their own language, then we waive it for 2 years. There's nothing worse than seeing a child sit in front of the test that we give them and not understand anything that's on the piece of paper and expect them to answer questions. I think it would be the same if you and I went to one of those foreign countries and they gave us an exam in their language and asked us, go ahead, pass it.
So just something as basic as trying to work with federal education requirements and saying, hey, give us a break here.
That was one portion I can tell you that is the families that I've met with, the parents have always been very keen on wanting to be educated in the language, making sure their children were educated in the language, so that they can go out and get productive jobs. There's no secret that refugees are very hard workers, and if you give them the job, they'll do the job. But sometimes it's merely a job of being a chambermaid or something else that doesn't need an awful lot of communication once you show them the job. But they want to go out and they want to be productive members of our community. And that means having to get a better education. And I can tell you that once a refugee child gets into the system and starts to learn, they start moving right to the top, which is a great thing.
Well, kids pick up languages so quickly. And as an adult, it's almost unfair because they do just learn it so quickly. At times, Mayor Gatsas, you and others in Manchester have said to the State Department, well, slow down. It's too much, too fast. Tell us what that was about.
Well, it wasn't so much that I was saying it. That was what the refugees were telling me.
Really?
You know, let's slow this down so that I can get a job. I'd like to go to work. You know, the State Department came in and met with me in my office, and I had the health department and the chief police in there, and they were trying to convince me that 80% of the people that were refugees had jobs and they were working. Well, you know, when you have a Lindt chocolate run, and people go to work for 2 weeks and then lose some of their benefits, I don't consider that employment. So it was more of let's give the refugees that are here an opportunity. Let's get them to participate in our society and be productive members. Get them an education. Get them a good job. And then let's bring the next group in. It was never about wanting to stop and say we don't ever want to see another refugee in the city of Manchester. It was about resettling the folks that were there, getting them good jobs. Look, there's no secret. You know, the mayor's office has an open-door policy. We've seen many refugees that have come in that when they were here, there was a family of five or six, I believe, that had a bedbug problem, and nobody was listening. And that's not easy for them to work their way through it. And when they bring in a little four-year-old girl that is bitten, that's not an easy sight to see.
Well, we'll talk more about jobs, housing, other issues in just a minute. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, refugees in the Granite State. As more refugees from Syria, Iraq, and other countries come to the U.S., we're looking at how the process of resettlement works, including the benefits and challenges for New Hampshire host communities. By the way, for more in-depth coverage of immigration and refugees, go to our website for links to stories in the Facing Change series with the New England News Collaborative. You can join us with your questions and comments right now at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR. exchange. And all of you, let's go to our listeners. And Nora joins us from Grantham. Hi, Nora. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I'm really proud that New Hampshire is welcoming Syrian refugees as it has been. And I feel that Syrian refugees, their values of standing up to tyranny and dictatorship and in the face of evil and trying to, seeking democracy is something that aligns with American values. So that's really positive. As you said and mentioned, they don't choose to become refugees. Syrians are very well educated. They are very civilized. They are very open to different cultures and different religions. And so they fit here. The thing is that and they have a positive net income on our economy because they tend to be so well-skilled and so educated, is that, you know, while I welcome refugees, I also look at the core problem that, you know, this is not sustainable. Look at what's happening in Syria, and till this day, we have tons of refugees leaving and going to Europe and going to Turkey, and they need our help. And I feel that we need a more sustainable solution at looking and providing safe zones, because I work with a lot of Syrian refugees, actually, that are in Jordan, and they tend to want to go home because they love where they're from and they love their culture. And so this is just kind of something I wanted to talk about.
I see. Okay, Nora, thank you. And let's talk about this maybe with you, Mukhtar, and you, Abdul Wakil. I remember, I'll turn to you first, Mukhtar, talking to some Bhutanese refugees, and this was an issue. You know, how long do you stay in that region in hopes that things will settle down and that you can go home? And how do you make the break and say, you know what, it's not going to work out there. I need to just start a new life. I wonder what you think about what Nora says. And Nora, thank you.
Yeah, so in the camp, you're not given a time frame of how long you should be there. It depends on what changes in your own country, the situation. In my case, in Somalia, civil war broke out in 1991. We came to Kenya by foot. We've been given a camp, and we live there as a refugee. Even prior to asking resettlement to the United States, we have sacked other countries like Mozambique and other countries that may potentially accept some of these people, because the life in the camp is limited. No doubt everyone would love to live in his or her country if it's peaceful, because you have every right in your country than you don't have in a refugee camp. Except the United States, when you come and you become citizen, it's not like a refugee camp. So you lose some culture, but it's more better environment here than in the camp. So you reach at a point where life in the camp isn't just the way you feel like it should have been for you. You lost your country, so you start to think about where can you change your life than the one you have right now. So
it's a process, isn't it?
It's a process. So in my case, we started asking for resettlement through UNHCR, 5 years in living into the refugee camp. And it took all the way to 2000 when we were told that United States may accept about 15,000 Somali refugees to be resettled.
Wow.
That process took from about 3 to 4 years before I was given an approval by Homeland Security saying, you know, you bring up your application to be resettled as a refugee in the United States has been approved. Because you go through every kind of steps you cannot imagine, but it's worth doing it, because then you have the hope of getting a better life than the life you live. So we had no doubt that what we were going through was worth doing it, because the outcome was better. And it was better for me coming here.
Well, that's the screening process that Jeffrey talked about, and that you, Abdul Wakil, talked about. And Abdul Wakil, to you and to Nora's question, and thank you, Nora, how did you feel about the idea of a safe zone? You know, let's stay there, be safe, and maybe the war will end, and maybe we can go back. I just wonder what your thoughts are there.
Yes. we are forced to leave Syria. We are not leave Syria as an option. We forced to leave Syria because of that muscles came over us. Every day we see some of our neighbors died in the street. So we forced to leave Syria to any other safe place.
So there really wasn't an option for you.
Yes, yes, it's not option, and we can't arrange it. We don't know what's the time we must leave. But we left Syria soonly. We left flee from death. So we searched about any other safe place, any other area. The country was open for us was Egypt. So we went to Egypt, waiting for resettle in another place.
Did you ever think, Abdul Wakil, about staying in Egypt, where it's at least a more similar culture to Syria?
Yes, it's not big difference in culture. There is some difference, but it's not big difference. The same language, same religion, same customs. A little bit difference in customs. So it's not big problems. But Egypt is, you know, it's not easy to live in Egypt. It's a big country, crowded and not really safe generally. So we of course we register in international institute searching about safe area to resettle us for a long time, because it seems our war, it's international war, it's a crazy war, no time on the horizon to when this will finish.
That's a really important point. It's so hard to know, Jeffrey, you know, is it going to stop? And Abdul Wakil pretty quickly surmised that it wasn't going to stop and that he just needed to get out. But it's hard for refugees to figure out, should I stick around, you know, in some sort of a safe zone? It doesn't sound like Abdul Wakil had an option there. But I just wonder what you think about that.
Well, I mean, Nora raises a great point. It's, you know, is this worldwide refugee crisis sustainable with 21.5 million people categorized as refugees? And it probably isn't. The United States has upped the number of people it can accept as refugees. President Obama upped it from 70 to 85,000 and now to 110,000. We do our part. I think what she's talking about is there a solution that can happen in the Middle East to stop the war and allow people to go back to Syria? I don't know. It looks pretty difficult to me based on what I'm reading and hearing. Can the United States accept more refugees? Those of us in this work would like to see that happen. We'd like to see us do our part and take more people here because we think that'll help the worldwide situation and it'll help this country too. But, you know, as a resettlement agency and someone running a resettlement agency in New England, our job is to receive the people who come here, help them, you know, reintegrate into the United States and get jobs and become productive citizens of our country.
Well, on that question of more, a couple questions. Here's one from Dennis on Facebook. And thank you, Dennis. He says, personally, as a vet and an officer in the American Legion, I don't think we should be spending a dime on refugees while we have homeless vets and a broken Veterans Administration. Dennis says, nor should we be giving billions to other countries for that matter. Dennis, thank you. And Mayor Getsis, I'm sure there are other people who feel like Dennis does. Let's fix our own problems.
Well, there's no question we've made promises to veterans, and those promises should have been kept and should be kept. And, you know, there's no reason why a congressman or a senator can walk into any hospital and get health care when a veteran has to wait, especially here in New Hampshire. That's just wrong. It doesn't make sense to me. The choice card is not working. People are out there. The veterans are out there, and there are a lot of homeless veterans that are out there that are looking for help. And they just want to say, okay, and, you know, we should all remember that freedom is not free, and, you know, he's right. The veterans should be taken care of by everybody in this country.
How do you feel, Mayor Getsis, about the sort of either-or argument? And we hear this often when new groups of refugees come. People say, you know, we can't spend money on this. We need to take care of our own. How do you assess that as a longtime public official?
Well, you know, when you look at it, back when I was first elected, we were getting 300 refugees a year. And I can tell you that the mayor of the city of Manchester never knew when a refugee was going to arrive. The only time I got a call was from the health department to say, we just put 6 refugees through their health clearance, and there's 2 adults and 4 children. That's the only time anybody ever told us who's coming and how many are coming.
The State Department didn't call you. The International Institute didn't call you.
They never called.
And that was your problem then.
Well, I think you would think that somebody would say, by the way, you know, you've got refugees coming. And they would say, well, you've got 300, and we reduce that to, and we said there's an awful lot of resettlement communities in the state of New Hampshire. Why is Manchester taking the entire burden? You know, why aren't some of those refugees going to Nashua, to Laconia, to some of the other 13 refugee resettlement communities that are in the state?
Or at least if you knew, you could hire more English as a second language teachers and sort of be prepared.
Well, it would certainly, and certainly the workforce would be prepared to accept some of these people. I think that that's what's most important. You know, I find it ironic that the federal government tells these poor refugees when they come to this country, the first thing they got to pay back is their airline ticket. So refugees pay back their airline ticket that gets them to this country before they do anything else. I find that amazing.
I have to get to that criticism of the International Institute, Jeffrey, and that's been a long-standing complaint that you guys haven't done a good enough job communicating with host communities like Manchester and Nashua.
Well, the mayor and I met last April, I think it was, and so we, you know, we have quarterly consultations with state officials, local officials, the police department, the school department, informing them who's coming into Manchester and Nashua, where we also resettle people. We fill out an abstract every year that is done in collaboration with the state refugee coordinator here in New Hampshire. We distribute our abstract to city and state authorities. There's comments on it. The State Department makes sure that there's a conversation that takes place between our office and the local officials on a regular basis. So we do our best to communicate. When I met with the mayor back in April, I gave him my cell phone, my card. He can call me anytime with any question about anybody he wants. I'm always happy to take a call. You know, we do our best to communicate. We're in constant contact with the school department. School department officials, the superintendent, some of his staff have been at our office on a regular basis. We had an event a few weeks ago there, and a good part of the central office staff came. We know them well.
Well, that's great, Jeffrey. But guess what? The mayor wasn't invited to that meeting.
You were invited. You were invited to the event. So you're on our email list.
Well, the email must be going somewhere else because there aren't many events.
You guys can work that out.
People in Manchester will tell you, I don't miss many events.
Oh, good. Oh, good, because I'm going to sign you up for one right after this. It's a fundraiser.
And
thank you.
To the point about Dennis's point, and again, Dennis, thank you so much, and definitely made by other folks over the years, that a concern that refugees pull resources. Now, though, in some of the reporting done by NHPR and other public radio stations around New England, we're finding, Mukhtar, that some business groups are saying, please come, because we have a shrinking workforce, an aging demographic. Refugees represent young families. I just wonder what economic contributions you see refugees making to northern New England especially.
Yeah, I think that's a one way to emphasize the opportunities. No doubt there's always a challenge in everybody's life. But the opportunity even, particularly it relates to Manchester, which is the biggest city in New Hampshire. When you take a look at the businesses, Manchester is now becoming a more friendly business city. Why? Because some of the jobs that were opened is filled by refugees. Take a look at Radisson Hotel. They had probably over thousands of housekeeping jobs no one would have filled if they were not refugees. As a result now, they have refugee women working there permanent, doing housekeeping and dishwashing. The hotel get a lot of businesses because their rooms are clean. People can come and sleep. Take a look, Easterseal. A couple of weeks ago, we had to do a project where Easterseal had over 100 positions open.
Wow, 100 positions
open. And they could not find people to fill in. So they invested to train refugees to fill in those positions. So we just finished the first session, and 12 refugees fill in those positions. Easter City is doing a great job in our city. They have all kind of programs, daycare, elderly services, all kind of program. What we want to see is do better, but as a result of the new arrivals filling in those jobs, Easter City is doing better. Radisson Hotel is doing better. Fleet Bakery, when I came in 2004, was very small production bakery company. They expanded their business now
because they have
over
workers.
100 refugees working for them permanent. So when you take a look at the opportunities, yes, there are challenges in getting new arrivals, but we also need to look what the future opportunities are. And those are opportunities because that's good for our city to see Manchester having a friendly business coming in, because the business that are already there are doing much better is what we would like to see. So I think if we work as a team, we can do better. And that's where organizations like us play a role in making sure that we do take serious on getting people off public services so they can get into the workforce.
Making those connections with employers.
Building confidence in employers that these people can work 7 days a week. And they rarely call out sick. Even I have seen people who can go to work even when they're sick. So that's how I look at the opportunities of getting new people into.
Well, the Maine Chamber of Commerce recently released a report recommending policies that would attract more immigrants to Maine to help address their workforce issue. Abdul Wakil, I wonder what work you would like to do. Yes. And if you've only been here not very long, so I just wonder if you can tell us about your job search as
yes,
well.
Yes, I'm an electrical engineer, and I have good experience in industrial control. And I was a technical manager for one of biggest plastic company in Syria for 5 years.
A plastics company, okay.
Yes, and I have I am internal auditor in ISO quality control assurance. And I am searching about work in my field that's better. Generally, Syrians don't want to rely for help, to rely on help, to waiting help from others. We want to work, we want to contribute in American civilization. Syrians in any place, you can see Syrians in Egypt and in Turkey, they established a lot of factories. They refresh whole cities where they were, because a lot of factories, a lot of experience in their fields. So they refresh the city. They are not waiting for help. They are making a positive for the places they are going to.
So when Syrians were in Egypt, you know, given their training, given their education, given their experience, I like the way you put it, they refreshed cities.
Yes, in Egypt and in Turkey. In Turkey, there's a big cities in Turkey, like Gaziantep. It's refreshed by Syrian. Also in Egypt, like 6th of October city, it's refreshed by Syrian, refreshed with factories, with bakeries, with a lot of another fields. A lot of experience, Syrian experience started to refresh that cities.
And I'm going to interrupt you, Abdul Wakil. I apologize. We are going to take another short break. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at refugee resettlement here in the Granite State. As more refugees from Syria and many other countries come to the U.S. and New Hampshire, we're talking about how the process of resettlement works, some of the benefits and challenges for the host communities and for the refugees themselves. By the way, for more in-depth coverage of this issue, visit our website for links to stories in the Facing Change series with the New England News Collaborative. You can join us now with your questions, comments, and thoughts. The number here in The Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. With us in studio, Mukhtar Idow, Executive Director of ORIS, the Organization for Refugee and Immigrant Success, based in Manchester. Mukhtar himself arrived as a refugee from Somalia in 2004. Today he's a U.S. citizen. Jeffrey Thielman is here, President and Chief Executive Officer of the International Institute of New England, which helps with refugee resettlement. Also, Abdul Wakil, he's a new Syrian refugee and an electrical engineer who arrived in New Hampshire just this fall with his wife, 3 children, and parents. Also with us, Ted Gatsis, Mayor of Manchester, former Republican state senator from the Queen City. Again, you can join us at 1-800-892-6477. And Shelley's calling in from Concord. Hi, Shelley. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi.
Go ahead, Shelley.
So, well, I don't want to seem as though I'm unsympathetic to these refugees coming in, and I think most people's heart just aches for the things they've been through. But I, you know, I was just speaking to a friend about this morning, and I've been thinking about this for a long time, because it is hard to put your finger on why are people uncomfortable with seeing other people receive kindness and support. And I have recently gone through more challenges in my life than I've ever faced at one time. I'm recently unemployed. I have a very sick parent.
Oh, Shelley, I'm
sorry.
My daughter
is in college and just moved away from home. And, you know, I've had some medical issues myself. And, you know, I am on the unemployment for the first time in my life. And that is quite an education.
So connect your struggles, Shelley, with our refugee show today.
Well, I'm just thinking, you know, I think what I was saying is, I think what people are upset by is when they hear that there are all these resources available for refugees coming in, and, you know, such as, you know, committees, like real life coaches to help them survive and find housing and food and jobs and et cetera. And, you know, there are not the same equal resources available for people that are your neighbors who are struggling, whether it's, you know, they're lower class or middle class.
Okay, and Shelley, I'm going to let you go just in the interest of time. I do apologize, but go ahead, Jeffrey Thielman. That theme that we got also from Dennis, our Facebook commenter, that, you know, limited resources and let's solve our own problems.
I mean, first of all, it's not a zero-sum game. And secondly, refugees and immigrants and other people who come into the state of New Hampshire, they build businesses, they build up the economic base of the state, they create jobs, they create wealth. Creating more wealth increases the tax base, allows us to help more people like Shelley. So, you know, we need more refugees and immigrants to come into the state of New Hampshire so that we can help more veterans and we can help more people who are struggling, because those people come and create wealth. Shelley's situation sounds like a terrible one. It's an awful situation to go through. Our refugees don't get a lot of assistance. It sounds like a lot of money. They get about $1,000 per refugee when they come here. They get minimal government assistance. And we work very, very hard, very quickly to get them off of assistance and get them to be sustainable by finding them good paying jobs as fast as we can.
Through groups like Mukhtar's group.
Through Mukhtar's group and other groups. Yeah, exactly.
Well, here's a comment from James on Facebook. He says, I don't think comparing spending on refugee resettlement and veterans is valid. America can do way more than one thing at a time. And last I looked, foreign aid, which I assume has refugee resettlement under its umbrella, accounts for less than 1% of federal spending. James says, this is not a case of priorities. There are two very different missions. So thank you again for that call. And I want to bring another voice into our conversation, all of you. Ken Siegel joins us. He's on the Board of Aldermen in Nashua, which also has had a large numbers of refugee resettlements. And Ken, welcome.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. And just tell us what refugee resettlement has meant for your city, Nashua.
Well, we haven't had near the number of refugees that Manchester has, so I don't think that we're seeing quite the same impact. And, I just want to separate out refugees, which indicate a status where people are leaving to flee a bad situation, clearly wars, and immigrants, which we have quite a number of immigrants in the city, a large immigrant population, which has been very, very productive and diverse. So it's hard to separate out the two as far as saying, okay, who's the refugees per se? Because when people come to Nashua, they all have to be assimilated in one way or another. They may have different language skills. They have different job skills. And so nobody says, okay, here's the bucket that you go into because you're a refugee. Here's the bucket you go into because you've come in a different way. I mean, at the State Department level, when people are being vetted, that's very, very different. So if you ask me personally what particular we do with refugees, I couldn't tell you the specifics because we don't have that many numerically, certainly compared to Manchester. I can tell you my speculations on impacts of people, but I can't tell you that there's been certain things that we have or haven't done because of a refugee crisis worldwide.
Nashua recently signed on to something, Ken, and there was some controversy around this, called Nashua Welcomes. What is that, and what was the story?
that was a piece of legislation to align the city with an organization that was basically, you know, saying let's accept more refugees. And my issue with the legislation wasn't that Nashua wasn't a welcoming city. That was never a problem. In fact, Nashua already has a declaration on the books about being a welcoming city. It's just that at the time, it seemed like a completely empty gesture. It was the kind of thing where if we approved it, it was great Facebook fodder for people to say, oh, look how wonderful we are. We didn't. It wasn't anything that I could see would positively change anyone's lives, wouldn't help somebody escape oppression. It was just a pat on the back for everybody and a feel-good speech. What I later found out, and we didn't know at the time, which was very disappointing, was there was actually some grant funding associated with accepting that welcoming city resolution and being aligned with that organization. I think had we known in advance, there would have been far less controversy. The controversy was in that there was no real tangible benefit associated with it. And you would think the people that were interested in passing this would have said, hey, oh, by the way, there's a $10,000 grant associated with this, the Adult Learning Center in Nashua.
Sure. So the Maine Chamber of Commerce recently said, you know, let's enhance policies that would bring more immigrants and refugees to Maine, given workforce shortages, given an aging demographic. You don't need me to tell you about Northern New England's demographic problems. What do you think, Ken, would this Nashua Welcomes effort help improve Nashua's workforce?
I think it has zero net benefit. That organization, that piece of legislation, to me, was just, again, I view it as a large bunch of people that are distant from what we have to deal with, providing feel-good websites and actually no practical help, as far as I could see. But if you're asking me, do we need a refugee population or immigrant population? Sure, absolutely. I think Nashua has shown that the immigrants that come to our city often come and are extremely productive, and we have good tools to assimilate, assuming that what's happening is they're not flooding in. Because, and it depends on where people come from. Everybody has different needs. My own wife fled the Khmer Rouge, so I'm married to somebody who is a refugee.
Cambodia, yeah.
Yes. I mean, her family found out the night before they left they were scheduled to be murdered. They fled, and my wife, as a child, was actually being shot at, bullets, fleeing to the border. And she ended up coming to the United States from a Thai refugee camp in 1984.
Wow, so you understand this issue quite closely.
Well, I live with it, and the thing that people have to understand, it's very, very difficult to get a handle on what assimilation really means. For example, my friends and I were having a conversation about, you know, Hitler came up, you know, with the nonsense of people calling other people Hitler, and my wife didn't know who Hitler was. And, you know, it's not a question of, well, how could somebody not know that? Well, if your childhood was spent in the killing fields of Cambodia, knowing about that stuff really wasn't something that was on the agenda. Now, she can tell you everything you want to know about Pol Pot.
Right, that's what I was thinking, sure.
That's a different experience. Now, I can project that out and say, okay, when people come here, let's assume we're talking about Syrian refugees right now, since that's the crisis that's most in the news. Imagine coming here and only speaking Arabic and being in a war situation, how completely dislocated that would feel. It's not like somebody coming from a country where there's a number of people already here that speak the language, that there's a community in place.
Sure, and I asked Abdul Wakil that earlier, you know, would it have been easier to stay, you know, in a country with a similar culture? So, but
right,
your wife made it, so.
For me, it would be speculative. I mean, I can't answer for that. I just think, you know, as a practical matter, how many Arabic speakers, for example, are there in Nashua? Probably not enough if we had a significant number of refugees that come over. But if people come over and they're vetted and there's not that many, then I think, sure, we could probably accommodate that. It's like anything. You can handle small amounts, but given a situation, the city budget and everything, we're facing pension crises from the state, which we have to refund. It's very, very difficult. I mean, everybody wants to do the right thing. It's just that the right thing for a single family or a couple of families is much easier to do than the right thing for hundreds of people coming in all at once,
okay,
where you just really don't have the assets in place to deal with that on a practical level.
Well, Ken, thank you very much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
That's Ken Siegel. Again, he's an alderman from Nashua. And all of you, let's go right back to our listeners. The number, 1-800-892-6477. And Kevin is joining us from Bedford. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Good morning. I love your show.
Good.
Long-time listener. I think Manchester is a best example of how this program should work. My kids went to Trinity. The mayor brought in a number of immigrants from Sudan, and they could barely speak English. And then by the end of that year, they were speaking English. We had them over for soccer parties. They were funny. They were hard workers. They were straight arrows. Perfect. And this is where I think Donald Trump needed to say a little more about his temporary ban. If you have Syrian cities that are blown up and you cannot get any background information, or you can't be vetted, that's potentially bad news for the communities they're going to. But again, the mayor has done a great job. Manchester should be an example for the entire country.
Thank you so much for the call, Kevin. And boy, we could talk about Kevin's points for a long time. It's interesting that he says you've done a great job, Mayor Gatsis, when in fact, you know, you didn't really have a lot of say. It was the State Department that decided this, along with other agencies. So,
well, as I said, you know, when I asked for a moratorium, it was not I asking for a moratorium. It was refugees that were saying, you know, we'd like to get jobs and learn the language so that we can be productive members of our community. You know, Mukhtar says that the Radis and the refugees that are there in housekeeping. Well, I'm not too sure that that's a job that a refugee wants because they're not high-paying jobs. Some of the fears that refugees have when they come to this country after they're here for a while is that the status quo changes. Parents are no longer talking about things that children will do. Kids are going to school and learning that you don't have to do that. Tell your father that if he hits you, you're going to have him arrested. I met with a group of mothers probably 2 years ago that don't understand that when a child is suspended, the process that they've got to go through. And I think those are some of the shortcomings. You know, the refugee community is a great community. I participate in an awful lot of events that they have because they know that I like to eat good food. So I can tell you that if Jeff had good food there, I would have been there. But again,
that we'll make it better
questionable
next time.
Meeting. You know,
no, it's not questionable.
Yeah. I'm going to let you guys work that out later on.
We'll talk off camera.
Abdul Wakil, I'm interested in your children. And because we've talked a lot about kids in schools, how they learn. How old are they, first of all?
Yes, I want to speak generally. When we came here, of course, different language, different culture, but it's very easy for us because we are positive. We don't want to wait. We are starting now learning English, me and my wife. Also, my parents, my father about 80 years, my mother 70 years old, and they started learning English.
Your 80-year-old father is learning English.
Yes, yes. And I hope a few months, we will learn English. We will be familiar with customs here. We will be positive for this country. And our children in the school now, familiar with the school. They are very happy with school, started learning English, of course, faster than us.
In 6 months, they'll be speaking
yes,
like Americans.
Yes, they will be our teachers in English.
Yeah, that happens a lot.
Yes. So, and we are coming to here according to a lot of investigations. I don't want American to afraid from that people that coming to here. Because we are not coming directly to America. We are coming a lot of investigation by American investigator, by a lot of vets. We are coming to here. And
that,
we will familiar here in a very short time because of fantastic international institute. They are helping us a lot in how to start English, how the main procedure is needed for us. Fantastic volunteers, people, that we face them, they are help us very much how to be familiar with others. They make us meet all wonderful people here to feel more comfortable in the life here. So I think a very short time will be familiar with the life here. We are very lucky with people here, with helpful here, from volunteer people and from International Institute.
We're running out of time, but I have to ask you how your kids feel about school. I mean, it must have been a shock for them.
No, really, it's not a shock for them, because children are more relaxed than the old people. There's no shock for them. They are going to school and playing there and learning English. They are coming back to the house very happy. So we hope to be positive where we were. We hope to be positive for this country to contribute in American civilization.
Well, all of you, we could have talked for another 3 hours. Thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. Happy New Year. This is The Exchange on NHPR.